This is Radio Boston. I'm Callum Borchers. It's Friday, which means it's a week in review, and we begin with yet another mass shooting, this time at the Borderline Bar and Grill in Thousand Oaks, California, on Wednesday. We have a link on our website, radioboston.org, to short bios of the 9 victims whose identities have been confirmed so far. The youngest was 18-year-old Elena Housley, niece of actress Tamara Mowry Housley. The oldest was 54-year-old Sheriff Sergeant Ron Helis, who told his wife over the phone that he loved her just before charging into the bar to confront the shooter. A full list of the victims known is available on our website. Investigators say they will comb through the alleged shooter's history to try to understand what happened.
We will be sure to paint a picture of the state of mind of the subject and do our best to identify a motivation.
Ventura County Sheriff Jeff Dean doesn't believe this could be a completely random act.
He's a resident of this area, and common sense would speculate that there's some reason he went here. He probably knew about it, but I don't think it was just, it's not like he was driving down the freeway and decided, I'm going to get off here.
Thousand Oaks Mayor Pro Tem Rob McCoy says the community will do its best to rally around the victims' families.
It is going to be a long, hard road, but this community will stand together and we'll love on these folks. That's the only way to get through it.
But some of the victims' family members say they want more than just thoughts and prayers.
I don't want prayers. I don't want thoughts. I want gun control, and I hope to God nobody else sends me any more prayers. I want gun control. No more guns.
So we start there with our Week in Review panel. Here with us is Susan Tracy. She's a former state representative, now a Democratic strategist and president of the Strategy Group. Susan, thank you for being here.
Thanks, Callum.
Also joining us is Richard Tesse, the former minority leader of the Massachusetts State Senate. Richard, welcome back to Radio
Boston.
Happy
to be back.
Richard, I'd like to start with you. And we just heard that mother's grieving anguish there. It's hard to listen to. And I'm wondering, just on the strategy she lays out, is she right in your mind about gun control? I know that as a state lawmaker, you voted for one version of an assault weapons ban, but not another one that you thought perhaps went too far. So where is that right balance between safety and Second Amendment rights?
Well, California does have among the strictest gun laws in the entire country. And obviously, this has been a terrible situation, as was the other recent mass
in Pittsburgh.
It's like every week there seems to be something happening. And, you know, barring confiscation of all the guns out there, we still have an immediate problem. And I do think that, mental health issues are something that have to really be looked at. I know that this particular individual was on the police radar. He had had an incident that they had the crisis team come out and talk to him. There are people out there right now that are falling, in the cracks, and they aren't getting, we either aren't identifying them or they're not getting the type, whether it's the Parkland shooter. I mean, there were a lot of warning signals, that maybe we need to do a better job focusing in on some of these people.
So we've heard the problem characterized a lot of different ways this week: mental health problem, gun control problem. California's governor-elect Gavin Newsom called it a uniquely American problem.
This is America. It's got to change. This doesn't happen anywhere else on planet Earth. And we can't let folks forget that. Can't lose sight of that. Can't allow this to be normalized.
Susan Tracy, is Gavin Newsom right there? I mean, do you think that we have allowed tragedies like this one to become the new normal?
I don't know. I hope it's not the new normal. But yeah, we've allowed them to happen. We talk for a while after it and do nothing. You can't help but go to that woman who talks about her son dying, who, by the way, was also in Las Vegas and didn't die there. So she's been through this twice now, once he survived and once he did not. So I heard some conversation about this. It's a public health crisis. I mean, thousands of people die every year, and it is uniquely American. We can't pretend it's not. And I don't disagree that there are mental health components to this that we should address, but guns are part of the problem, and we do nothing. I am encouraged by this election. You saw Lucy McBath run and win in Georgia, and she was a gun an anti-gun advocate. We have a number of new legislators. We have Democrats controlling the House. At least maybe there's an opportunity to finally move this discussion to a more reasonable and thoughtful place and have some rules that, you know, it's not going to be the be-all and end-all, but boy, it would be nice to do something.
So just for a sense of where the public stands on this issue right now, we just had the midterm election on Tuesday, and according to an NBC News exit poll from Tuesday, 60% of midterm voters said that they support stricter gun control measures. That included 42% of gun owners. But of course, Richard, that's a very broad term. We don't know exactly what they mean. They could just mean ramped up background checks. And in your view, with a divided Congress, is there any real chance of meaningful gun control legislation passing in the next term?
Well, I you got to look at the situation. And from what I understand so far, that the shooter was using an illegal extended magazine on his weapon.
His legally purchased weapon, right? It was a combo,
his legally
right?
purchased yeah. weapon, but he had modified it in an illegal way. And, I think common sense gun measures, yeah, but I think ultimately, Aaron, with that, unless you confiscate all the weapons that are out there, we're going to probably continue to see this type of horrific situation. And, we can't lose sight of the fact that there are people doing this. And, in the Parkland situation in Florida, I think that, again, when there are warning signs out there, there are constitutional issues, but I think we have to be more vigilant about trying to identify some of these people beforehand, before this type of thing happens.
So I think one of the other aspects of this conversation that we had a little bit earlier in the week stemmed from a conversation in our own meeting in the morning here at Radio Boston. We heard from one of our producers, Zoe Mitchell, and she was talking about one of the side effects here being that people maybe don't feel as safe in public spaces going out. We've seen these shootings happen in a variety of settings, nightclubs, bars, movie theaters. We had Zoe in studio earlier this week. Just to remind folks, this is what she said.
You know, in these past 2 weeks alone, we've seen coverage of these shootings at a house of worship in Pittsburgh, a yoga studio in Florida, and now a bar, in California. And it's just kind of piling on to the places that, I feel like I can't go or we can't go and feel safe anymore.
So, Susan, what about that sentiment, that the terror of these shootings is sinking in and making people more and more uncomfortable going out?
Well, I think you have to keep going forward, right? We can't. But does it make us all pause and think a little differently? Does it happen so often now that you do kind of wonder every once in a while? Absolutely you do. I always think that when Newtown happened, I said to myself, boy, when a bunch of 5 and 6-year-olds get killed, our country's going to really care and we're going to do something. And it just keeps happening. It is an epidemic. It is something cultural is wrong. And it's going to require a lot of people working together to try to make a difference. And that's just not happening.
And the prospect would seem to be even increasingly difficult with a split Congress in the new term, right?
Well, so. I'm comforted a little bit by some of the victories that took place and some of the movement, at least on the House side. And I do think it needs to start to become almost a single issue for voters, because that's the only way you're going to get everybody to the table.
All right. So let's talk about how we got to that divided Congress a little bit, going back to the midterm election of Tuesday. And we'll start here locally in Massachusetts. The polls closed right at 8 o'clock, and it was really just right after that that two of the big races were called almost immediately, both the governor's race and the U.S. Senate race. Senator Elizabeth Warren won re-election easily. She got 60% of the vote against Republican Jeff Deal. And in her victory speech on Tuesday, she said that her win was part of a women's movement that had launched the day after President Trump was inaugurated.
They refused to let anyone shut them up or stand in their way. And that is how real change begins.
Meanwhile, Jeff Deal said in his concession speech that even though he lost the race, he doesn't feel like the fight is over.
While the outcome is not what we wanted, we've laid the foundation for taking Massachusetts back for the working people, I think.
And meanwhile, the governor's race was even more lopsided than the Senate race, but in favor of the other party. Republican incumbent Charlie Baker coasted to victory over his Democratic challenger, Jay Gonzalez, with 67% of the vote. Gonzalez had claimed during the campaign that Baker lacked vision. And then on Wednesday, Governor Baker said that a lot of progress can be made through incremental change.
We get accused sometimes of being the 3 yards in a cloud of dust administration. But if you add up 3 yards over time, if you're relentless about it, you can make a lot of progress.
And there were a lot of other notables from Tuesday night as well. Massachusetts elected its first black congresswoman. That was Ayanna Pressley. The big money ballot question number one about nurse staffing ratios was resoundingly defeated. Lori Trahan became the new representative from Massachusetts' 3rd District. So there's a lot to unpack there, Richard, to say. What were your big takeaways from Tuesday?
Well, for Massachusetts, I think civility wins in a way. You know, the people appreciated the fact, you know, people from out of state who asked me about the results after, yeah, they said, how could Massachusetts, being
for Warren and Baker,
such a Democratic state, elect Charlie Baker, Republican, overwhelmingly to another term, and at the same time elect a firebrand, you know, Elizabeth Warren, to another term in the Senate. And there were a lot of people who pulled the lever for both of them. I think it says a lot about the Massachusetts electorate that they are well informed and that they do appreciate the fact that, you know, in the governor's case, that he has been bipartisan. He's been willing to work with people. They view him, I think, more as a manager than a politician. And I think it's a, you know, pretty much a resounding, you know, stamp of approval for the last 4 years. And generally, and I think for all incumbents in Massachusetts, people are really happy with the direction that the state is going in. We have problems, but I do think that they look at the legislature. I mean, you had one House member, one Senate member lose their reelection bids, both Republicans, by the way. But for the most part, you know, all of the legislators were reelected, and people are, you know, status quo here in Massachusetts.
Don't you have to say that, though, Richard? Let's remind folks, you're a former running mate of Charlie Baker's, right? You're obligated. No, but in all seriousness, we heard from Eric Fernstrom, another Republican, this week, saying he thinks that even though Charlie Baker won, that the Massachusetts GOP is still the party of Donald Trump. It sounds to me like you don't see it that way.
Well, that, I think, Charlie had the ability to bring people in. You know, the Republican base in the state is 34, 35, 36%, which Jeff Diehl did a good job of getting, but he didn't get anybody beyond that. And in order to win an election in Massachusetts, you need to expand your, you know, your base. And Charlie, he showed that there are 66% of the people in the state willing to vote for a Republican, just the right Republican.
Go ahead, Susan.
There are more independents than there are Democrats or Republicans.
Right.
To win in Massachusetts, you have to win with independents and Democrats if you're a Republican. And Charlie Baker did that, and Jeff Diehl did not. He didn't go beyond the core Trump base.
All right, so let's talk a little bit about Elizabeth Warren. And as I mentioned a moment ago, we spoke with Eric Fernstrom. He's the former longtime strategist for Mitt Romney. When we talked to him earlier in the week, he said he didn't think that Elizabeth Warren's win on Tuesday was enough to sort of propel her into a national campaign for the White House.
Elizabeth Warren won, and that's good enough for another term in the Senate. But I think she underperformed here in Massachusetts. For instance, the Republican governor, Charlie Baker, got more votes than she did right here in a deep blue state. And I think what that signals is that she's not a dominating political force in her own backyard.
Susan Tracy, do you agree with Eric Fernstrom there? Did Elizabeth
Warren
underperform?
No, of course she didn't. She got over 60% of the vote. And what I find most interesting about her win is when Jeff Diehl was, you know, kind of running and coming at Elizabeth Warren, his message was, she's running for president. She's out of state. She's not here. And that clearly did not come through in the voters. And sort of picking up on where Eric Fernstrom's going there, one, Elizabeth Warren did 37 town halls in Massachusetts. So she did her work and her hard work here in the campaign. But in terms of a presidential race, she also had supporters working on campaigns around the country. She raised and contributed millions of dollars to candidates around the country. And she did a lot of groundwork for a potential, if she decided to do it, presidential run. So I think that where I disagree with Eric quite strongly is she won solidly here. She did her homework. She got her base out, and she also expanded beyond the confines of Massachusetts and made friends.
Richard, let's talk about that ballot initiative that we mentioned a moment ago. Question one was about mandatory nurse-to-patient ratios in hospitals, and it was resoundingly defeated after looking like it was going to be pretty competitive earlier in the race. This was a big blow to the nurses' union that had pushed hard for these mandatory staffing levels. Do you take any sort of broader thing away from this race as far as the power of labor in the state, or is this kind of a one-off?
This is a complicated question and a lot of and a local question, too, because a lot of the community hospitals do not have union nurses, and those nurses were live in the community, and they were out. I think Susan and I know that for many years this issue came up in the legislature and did not make it through the legislature.
Which is why it's on the ballot.
Which is why it was on the ballot. And it sounds good until you recognize that it could have, and I think the case was made, you know, pretty effectively, that you can't have a one-size-fit-all management style in every single hospital, you know, across the Commonwealth. You need some flexibility, and I think ultimately that's what ended up doing them in.
I also think you can't underestimate the power of both money and message. There was a lot of money on the side of no on that vote.
$24 million.
Right. And the message piece was really interesting because it was a ballot question that was supposed to be about nurses, but the nurses, at least it was portrayed that the nurses were divided. And I think if there's a hesitancy, the default is status quo. Like, why are we making this change? So I think money and message really were powerful for question one.
Right. When we polled it at WBUR, we found that nurses were almost equally divided on the issue, which I think was notable because the proponents of question one had been saying in their early marketing that 86% of nurses were voting yes, and that proved to be an exaggeration.
In my area, you have Melrose Wakefield Hospital. You have Winchester Hospital. Most non-union, most of the most of the employees there, again, were against it. So you had a lot
in a funny way, there was a lot of grassroots conversation on that. You really do see the power of nurses in that in a funny way, because you talk to so many people who said, I know someone who's a nurse and she told me to vote X or Y. You know, it's very interesting.
And it was usually based on the hospital they worked
in. Yeah. You don't find that on a question very often, that personal touch to it. And there was a lot of personal touch on that question.
All right. So all these local races fit into the broader national landscape. And we had talked about the possibility of a blue wave sweeping the country. We sort of got a little bit of that. We got the Democrats taking over the House. But if you believe White House Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders, it was not a wave. It was merely a ripple.
I think James Carville said it best when he said anybody that was anticipating a blue wave tonight's not going to get it. Maybe you get a ripple, but I certainly don't think that there's a blue wave.
James Carville, of course, the longtime Democratic strategist, formerly worked for the Clintons. Susan Tracy is the White House press secretary, right? This was just a ripple.
You know, it's funny. I'll tell you, just personally, on Tuesday night when I went to bed late, I was happy about, you know, obviously winning the House. But I thought, boy, it would have been great if we could have picked up Florida or we could have picked up Georgia. I didn't think Texas was really ever in play. And none of those are decided. It's been such a funny race from my perspective. So it is a wave that has a lot of, momentum to it. It's just kind of swept over the few days. And as each of these races, whether it's Manchin going, and then, as I mentioned, McBath and that Georgia race, we picked up a couple of seats in Florida and in Georgia and in Texas that only came from the top of the ticket. So as I've had time to reflect and as the real votes have been counted, it's been pretty amazing, actually.
All right. So as you said, some of those races that looked like maybe they were over have tightened up. We could be headed for recounts in multiple races.
Absolutely.
In Florida, also Georgia and Arizona.
And the trends were so, even in races that were lost by such small margins, with trends left in each of those districts. So I think it was a great day.
So we have some pretty explosive accusations in Florida in particular. The current governor, Rick Scott, he currently leads his Senate race against the incumbent Democrat Bill Nelson. And he's alleging that liberals are committing electoral fraud to steal that election.
Every day since the election, the left-wing activists in Broward County have been coming up with more and more ballots out of nowhere. We all know what is going on. Every person in Florida knows exactly what is happening. Their goal is to keep mysteriously finding more votes until the election turns out the way they want.
We've heard President Trump also suggest that there could have been voter fraud down there. So, Richard, to say, what do you make of those accusations? I know that voter ID laws, for example, are something that you've suggested was a reasonable measure that, you know, you have to show an ID to get into a federal building. It's reasonable to expect you to do that at the polls. But is voter fraud something you're concerned about?
It had to be Broward County.
Yeah, it's always Broward County. It's always Florida.
I'll tell you what, if it was anywhere else, you know, you don't think. And, you know, it's kind of funny how this popped up because it was Marco Rubio who started last night saying, you know, there's something going on.
The Republicans are ahead. They wanted to stop now, so it's a muddy the
well,
water.
Well, I guess we'll see. I think, again, it's Broward County, and you got to kind of raise your eyebrows that there are that, you know, I don't know why there is that many, you know, tens of thousands of votes lying around that they, you know, they forgot about and, you know, they're
finding we don't know
now.
That happened either, so there's a...
But we'll see. We'll end up seeing, but...
Right. I just think it's pretty simple. Everyone who voted should have their vote count, and if it takes a few extra days to get there, who cares? And the outcome should be how people voted. It's just not that hard.
But it is interesting, you know, just my take on the election in general. I didn't think it was all that bad, and Florida is probably a good case if it holds up, that they were able to keep the governorship, keep the United States Senate seat. They were able to win the Ohio Senate seat, and add seats to the Senate. So definitely like a split decision. And as most people know, in a off year midterm election during the first year of a president's cycle, they inevitably lose a lot of seats. So, you know, if Donald Trump wasn't on the ballot and it was just a regular election, the party in power would be favored to lose, you know, a sizable portion enough to lose the House. So,
given the
he had a lot to do with this election,
also,
but
yeah, and given the economy, it's kind of stunning that as much was lost as it was.
But
and
presidents
I think,
don't gain seats in a midterm, and so losing the House, but you know, there was also a pretty good bright spot that they picked up these extra Senate seats. And I say to people, you know, blue states are bluer, the red states are redder. As a result of this, so the suburbs are a little bluer right now, and but split decision on to 2020.
Yeah, and
we'll have to agree to disagree.
Well, but there are not all of the big political news nationally was election related, or at least not directly. Though we also lost the Attorney General, by the way, this week. Attorney General Jeff Sessions stepped down on Wednesday at the president's request, and on that day we spoke with the former U.S. Attorney here in Massachusetts, Carmen Ortiz, and she said that it gives her some concern about what the implication could be for the Robert Mueller investigation.
The new appointee could be someone that the president could certainly try to influence in matters going on currently and moving forward within the Department of Justice.
And, of course, the acting attorney general at the moment is Matthew Whitaker, who has been very skeptical of the investigation, although he has spoken positively about Robert Mueller personally. Susan Tracy, what's your level of concern here?
President Trump has been talking about getting rid of Sessions for a while. I think it's interesting the day after the Democrats take over the House, he pushes Sessions out and puts in someone who is not confirmed by the Senate, which is problematic out of the gate, and two, has a history of making statements sort of saying this Russia thing is, you know, it's already been decided, it's over. I think there are a lot of problematic things, and I think we've seen a president who doesn't really seem to care about anything except protecting his own turf and himself. And so I think we should all be concerned that's in jeopardy.
Go ahead, Richard.
If he fires Mueller, then obviously, you know, that's an issue. But he didn't pick a nobody. And I didn't really know that much about this guy, but he has been the chief of staff to the attorney general. And prior to that, he was a U.S. attorney in Iowa.
Did go through a confirmation process.
He was confirmed by the Senate. So, I mean, this is somebody who you know, does have ethics and, you know, and the fact that he's going to, you know, people think he's just going to become a stooge and trade away all those ethics, you know, people are painting him a certain way right now for a reason. And, you know, it was kind of nice during the election that this whole Mueller thing wasn't an issue and there were other issues. Mm-hmm. And it's like now the day, you know, right after the election, here we go again. We're back onto this Russian narrative. So we'll see what ends up happening.
All right, let's finish our review on a somewhat lighter note with our hubbubs. These are those little stories that may have slipped below the headlines, but we think should get a little bit of attention nevertheless. Susan Tracy, let's begin with you.
Yeah, I'm going to stay with elections since we're on that theme, and I'm going to talk about a Trump supporter, a brothel owner, a star of HBO's Cat House, Republican Dennis Hoff, won his bid for the Nevada legislature, despite the fact that he passed away about a month ago, hours after a combination campaign rally and birthday party with porn star Ron Jeremy, anti-tax crusader Rover Norquist, and Sheriff Joe Arpaio.
I think my favorite part of that story, though, Susan, was that some Republican voters had said they wouldn't have supported David Hoff had he been alive, but voted for him because he was dead, seriously, because they knew he couldn't be seated and it would force a special election and give the GOP another chance.
That's going to be a new technique, evidently, running dead.
We are a very diverse party.
And Richard, how about you? What's your love of
just the week? We just went through this whole election. It's like a lot of noise. People are tired of it. A lot of people want a break. But in that spirit, it's a little early, but the governor did declare November 17th in Massachusetts a day of civility. Put it on your calendar. And not only being civil to people, but also the proclamation also called for an act of kindness. So when you see somebody out on the street, or maybe even on the internet, you can be nice to people.
Good comments.
Good and right.
All right, but I'm going to put the civility to a test here with my hubbub, though. The Wall Street Journal did a very deep dive this afternoon into an important question, which is Boston cream pie actually the world's most delicious cake? Controversial. Cake, not pie.
Huh.
Debate. Richard, is it a pie or a cake, first of all, and is it the most delicious?
I'd say cake.
It's cake.
Yes. Okay.
It's also the official dessert of Massachusetts, by the way.
Yeah, exactly. Parker House, right?
That's exactly right. And also the Wall Street Journal was giving high reviews to flour bakeries. A version of the Boston cream pie as well, with recipes included.
Nice.
Susan Tracy, former Massachusetts state representative and now a Democratic strategist and president of the Strategy Group. Thank you so much for being
here. Thanks, Callum.
And Richard Tessay, the former minority leader of the Massachusetts Senate. Richard, thank you for joining
us. Nice to see you.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Callum Borchers, and this is Radio Boston.